This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Glenn Holt.
And Brian Levinka.
And on this evening's program, we actually have queer voices again because we were off there for a couple of weeks because of the conventions. So, of course, we have news wrap from This Way Out. Then we're going to have Sue Lovell from the Houston City Council to discuss her visit to the Democratic Convention as a member of the Democratic National Committee and the GLBT role of the party. And then in the second hour, Ray Hill will be here to talk about the life and times of Del Martin. And we'll also have the other parts of This Way Out that we normally run in the second hour and in the first hour as well. But leading things off this evening, we're going to have David Elliott as soon as he calls in, but that hasn't happened yet. So what were you all doing while we were gone?
Well, of course, there was lots of things to watch on TV. And we'll be discussing that during the show, certainly our angles of what was going on nationally in the politics, and it's pretty scary out there.
Well, we watched Gustav, and now we've got Ike going to come to visit. So, you know, there's a weather and everything going on, as well as the politics. There was a few storms there, too.
Yes, and actually the Daily Show's take on all this was pretty funny, if you got to see it. Some really incredible reporting that they did, especially their coverage of the men's room at the Minneapolis airport. They had all their male correspondents working that angle, which was pretty interesting. But we don't want to overdo it, although tonight will be pretty heavy on the politics because it's important. And actually what's even more important is a lot of the local politics that we'll be covering in the upcoming weeks, along with many other things now that we're back on track to be on the show weekly. We have a fundraiser coming up in October, and of course we'll be asking for your support. And also remind you that if you did pledge in the most recent pledge drive, that please do fulfill your pledge because it's very important to the station.
You know, all of us here at Queer Voices are glad to be back. You know, I hope you missed us. I know that there was a lot going on at both the Democratic and Republican conventions, and the station was covering that. But most importantly, we for those 2 weeks, the GLBT community didn't have their voice out here in filling you in on what's going on in the community, as well as the interesting guests that we have here. We're fortunate tonight to have two incredible guests, and it's nice to be back on the air.
That's two guests locally. We have one that will be calling in from Washington in just a second, and I'm very anxious to hear what David Elliott's angle is on all this that's going on.
He always has such interesting angles on things.
Very good with the tapping and the dancing, but there's no ringing, so you're probably going to have to call him, which means that we'll listen to a piece of music while you do that. How's that?
Hey, thank you.
Okay.
Everybody's a hopeful in the city of talent and time. High on determination to live it out. Everybody's distracted when they dance with one eye on the door. So afraid to be missing the next best thing. There's something more. All these days are not how we dreamed they would be. And those we love are not who we thought we would see. And no one here can remember the name of his hometown or where it came from. There's not much here, so we can give it. And run. So announce your departure and settle the debts that you owe. 'Cause they know that we're leaving and won't
There's not much here, so we can give it up and run. All this restless reconciling goes down sweet. And it was, but it wasn't. And it does, but it doesn't make this place the home I need. Whoa, these days are not how we dreamed they would be. And those we love are not who we thought we would see. And no one here can remember the name of his hometown or where it came from. There's not much here, so we can give it up. There's not much here, so we can give it up. There's not much here, so we can give it up and run.
Is Queer Voices.
Mr. Carpentier, guru extraordinaire, open your heart to the masses. You have lived 20 lives, I could be satisfied watching the world through your glasses. Mr. Carpentier, I have so much to learn, why don't you come here and teach me? Needless to say, I've been slipping away to a place where nobody can reach me. And I don't know if I was made for this world. They point and they stare at my dress like a 12-year-old girl. You smile like a child and I'm just squirming in my own skin. You lead me through the soccer field to the swing sets once again. Go through the motions like fish in the oceans and paint the town red with the blood of the dead. We're all pretending the world isn't ending and everything's fine as we shop and we dine. But you're fat and you're free and you're taking up space. Drive your SUV while you're stuffing your face. Your children are spoiled and addicted to oil and they buy lots of plastic and they throw it away. And I don't know if I can make it through this day. The ocean's too high and the sky is too gray. Weight of the world, gravity is finally setting in. Take me through the soccer field to the swing sets once again. Drink like a fish and I hit like a girl and I'm scared of myself and I hide from the world, but your heart's like a whale and you're built like a tank and you keep me alive. I'd like to thank you, cause there were times I couldn't make it through my day when I lost my shit and they should have carted me away. But you're always there, you care and you believe in what I do. Wanna go through the soccer field to the swing set. Just me and you. Let's swing high. Let's swing high. So high we touch the sky. Oh.
bit of music to start us off there on Queer Voices. First, from 2007, the CD Best of Intentions. That was Phil Putnam and a song titled Not Much Here. Then, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Mr. Carpentier. That was Robert German, the title of the cut, Mr. Carpentier, from his 2008 EP titled Unplug. Unplug. There we go. So, I think we have David Elliott on the line with us now.
Well, we do, and good evening to you.
Good evening, David.
How are y'all?
We're just fine. What's going on there in Washington?
Tell us all about it.
Well, you know, it's gotten kind of interesting, I have to tell you. Let me give you just a brief rundown on where we're looking on the presidential race, because that's really what, you know, everybody's thinking about and talking about right now. The last time I was on your program, we didn't have a Democratic vice presidential nominee. We didn't have a Republican vice presidential nominee. And we didn't really know where the race stood, and now it is suddenly becoming it's suddenly coming into focus. We have of course Joe Biden on the Democratic side. We have the mysterious and surprising Alaska Governor Sarah Palin on the Republican side, and we could go on and on and on about her. But let me give you the bottom line tonight. This is going to be a close race.
Isn't that strange?
It is kind of strange. But, you know, all along, whether we were looking at electing the first African-American president ever or the first woman president ever, we were probably looking at a pretty close race. So what's going to happen now? And how is this race going to play out? And here's the deal. If we spend the next 57 days, it's 57 days until Election Day, it is 22 days until early voting starts in some places like Ohio. If we spend the next 22 days or the next 57 days arguing about small things like Sarah Palin or the bridge to nowhere or that ugly green backdrop that keeps showing up behind John McCain when he gives his speeches, then we will lose this election. If, on the other hand, we argue about big things, the economy, the price of gas, the price of health care, the war in Iraq, access to education, then we as progressives will win this election. And that's pretty much what it comes down to. It's going to be a fight over issue terrain over the next 57 days. And which side can make its arguments out there, which side can put its arguments out there most effectively.
Well, and that's really important, but it just doesn't seem like that we're doing that.
Well, Jack, it has been a difficult week or two for the Democrats and for the Obama campaign. The Republicans had their convention. They were able to fire up their base.
Yes.
with the choice of Sarah Palin. But you know what the good news is? They're not winning in a single state that the Obama campaign has targeted to win. Republicans are in trouble in Iowa, in New Mexico, in Colorado, in Virginia. It's a close race in Ohio and Missouri and some other states. Right now, if the election were held tomorrow on a Tuesday, Democrats would win, Obama would win. It would be a little bit closer than I'd like to see it. But this thing hasn't played out yet. You know, people do need to realize organizationally, Obama has a vastly superior ground game.
Yes, even in states that aren't even close.
Yeah, sure. In Virginia, for instance, Obama has 42 offices open. McCain has 9. In Alaska, Obama has 4 states open. McCain, Palin have 0. So, you know, there you have it. It's the ground game's going to make up for a couple of points, but this thing's not done yet. I thought that perhaps Obama would be running away with the race right now, and it's turned out to be a lot closer than I expected it to be.
Well, do you think partly because we have a lot of the Roe operatives working in the McCain, and that basically McCain is just running the race that George Bush did 8 years ago?
They're doing some of that, Jack, and yet they're also running away from Bush.
No two ways about it. They're running away from Bush, but they're using the tactics that they used 8 years ago.
Precisely, and the guy I know, the guy who's running the McCain campaign. His name is Steve Schmidt. He is 37 years old. He's a pretty young guy. They're doing a really, really good job. Just like our guy, David, I shouldn't say our, because, you know, you, of course, Jack, you and the folks with you, you know, y'all don't endorse candidates. I can myself, because I'm a private citizen coming on as a guest. David Axelrod, you know, campaign manager for Obama, is doing pretty well. But look, the last month or two, you know, ever since the McCain campaign shook up his campaign, they've been running a really, really good race. Now, at the end of the day, we're going to take them down. You have to look at the ground game. You have to look at the issue environment. You have to look at what Americans are thinking about in this day and age. And that's why I think we're going to win. But it is going to be a little bit closer all along than I perhaps thought it was going to be. I initially thought it was going to be an electoral landslide, and now I can't really make up my mind between whether it's going to be a really, really, really close election, such as 2000 and 2004, or whether it's going to be a moderately close election.
Well, what do you think about the other races, the senatorial races and the congressional races? Do you think that, not necessarily the pulling effect, but the fact that, you know, everything is so wrong? And it was really interesting. There was a great discussion on Fresh Air today with Thomas Friedman in the New York Times about the fact that the Republicans are even holding up the subsidies for the alternative energy just to make the Democrats look bad.
Oh, yeah. The next 3 weeks, Jack, in Congress are going to be interesting. But look, the outcome of races both in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, the outcome is done. Democrats are going to be picking up some 10 to 30 seats in the U.S. House and an absolute minimum of 6 seats, perhaps as many as 10 or 12 in the U.S. Senate. That's something that we can say is already done. It's just done. We know it's going to happen. It's a little bit different dynamic than the presidential race.
Okay, and then they'll probably disinvolve Lieberman at the same time.
Well, you know what? Lieberman is going to lose his committee chairmanship, and he is going to lose his ability to participate in the Democratic caucus, and he deserves both of those things. For his performance at the Republican convention. He's gone. He's out of there.
Interesting.
Yeah, this is Jennifer Renee. Hey, Palin, and I don't want to dwell on her, what kind of impact did that really have on the undecided women out there with her in the race since the, you know, Hillary had all those supporters. And, you know, if you listen to the talk in the media, that many of them weren't going to vote for her, were holding back their vote. Is Palin really pulling any of those women their way?
Jennifer, that is an outstanding question. There have been three impacts. First of all, Palin certainly has brought in hardcore right-wing anti-choice, anti-gay Republican women. Second, there's a relatively tiny demographic out there, and I've seen the crosstabs on this. There's a relatively small number of independent women swing voters who live in rural areas or what we call the exurbs that have reacted warmly to Palin. She's won some of them over. However, by and large, Sarah Palin has not brought in the independent women demographic in the United States. And in fact, her selection has been relatively meaningless among independent swing voters, male or female. In fact, this might surprise y'all. She's been polling about 6 to 7 percentage points better among male voters than female voters.
That is an interesting bit of statistics. Do you have any idea why?
I'm afraid I do. You know, they say that men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
Yes.
I think that women are looking at Palin's candidacy in terms of the issues, and some men out there, I think, might be looking at her candidacy in terms of what she looks like.
Yeah, she is sort of a little hottie, isn't she?
Yeah, I heard the term trophy VP.
Doesn't really do a whole lot for me, I have to tell you.
Well, but I see what you're talking about. She has that little, and I'm sure that that's a well-tailored look, is the hair up, the glasses. She looks like somebody's school teacher.
Well, you know, I guess there are folks out there that have their, you know, female librarian fantasies and what have you. But, you know, what are we going to do with that? I mean, we counter with Biden, you know, boring old white guy. But seriously, look at the key demographics that are going to decide this election. No key swing voter is really going to wake up on election day and say, you know what, you know, there's Biden over here or Sarah Palin over here, and that's what's going to, you know, convince me how to cast my vote. They're not going to be deciding between Palin and Biden. They're going to be deciding between McCain and Barack Obama.
Oh, absolutely.
And certainly there's been a lot of voter registration around the country and a lot more young people energized. I mean, you know, even here in Texas for the primary, and we hope it's going to follow through that these people are going to go out and vote in the general election, even though here in Texas this is definitely not a state where it's contested for the presidential election. But certainly states like Virginia and some of those other states, I think it's very important that do you think the young people are going to go out and vote this time?
They definitely are, Jack. And don't underestimate Texas. The polling in Texas has been from the get-go, has been a little bit more favorable this cycle toward the Democrats than we might have expected. The last most fresh poll I saw had McCain up by only 7 percentage points over Obama, which was very, very surprising.
Yes, yes, considering how much Bush won in the last election.
Exactly. And I also understand that there is an outside chance, although maybe not that much of an outside chance, that Democrats might capture the Texas House of Representatives.
That, yes, especially since the fact that it has been redistricted against the Democrats.
Yeah. yes, that's something to keep an eye on. You've got a lot of local races in Harris County that you're going to be looking at.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's very, very important to us locally, the fact that there is no countywide office being held. There's no Democratic judge in office right now in Harris County. And, of course, the scandals just keep coming up, and I don't know how much you're able to keep in touch with that, but just another county commissioner now has gotten himself or gotten, it's been made public that he's in trouble. And a really interesting thing, in fact, at the next caucus meeting, Wayne Del Schifino, who has helped uncover the problems in the sheriff's office and the DA's office, will be speaking.
I noticed the county commissioner little brouhaha that came up. I try to make it a point to check out cron.com, you know, so I can see Houston Chronicle politics online, as well as the Austin American Statesman's website and Burnt Urns report. Those are some of my favorite websites for following Texas politics. But yeah, look, people, Texas is going to go purple, and then a couple of years after that, they're going to go blue. You know, people stereotype Texas as being a Republican state, but I'm telling you, not much longer.
Well, yes, the demographics are definitely changing. So, David, do you think it's a possibility that this thing may go beyond November 4th, that we may have something that happened 8 years ago?
You know, Jack, I'll be back on the show the first Monday of October, and we're going to have a lot better idea of what's going down there. I'm pretty optimistic. You know, you have to look at the underlying narrative of what is going to be driving this presidential election. You know, we just found out last Friday that our unemployment rate had spiked from 5.7% to 6.1%. We shed another 84,000 jobs in August. We found out that we have now lost 605,000 jobs for the year. Americans are going to be thinking about that when they go to the polls.
Yes, and the whole thing about drill, drill, drill is not the answer.
Right. I think Americans are smart enough to see beyond that. At the end of the day, Jack, I don't think it's going to be a very close election. Although I will grant you and I will concede that right now it feels like one.
Okay. David, tell us what you do during for your day job.
Well, Jack, for my day job, I'm the communications director for U.S. Action and TrueMajority.org. You can find us online at TrueMajority.org. And once a month, I'm happy to come on to Queer Voices and basically give the update about what's happening in Washington, D.C. and across the country in terms of politics.
Great. David, thank you very much for joining us, and you're listening to Queer Voices.
Thank you, David.
Thank you all.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 6, 2008. The Australian government introduced legislation in Parliament this week to grant a number of rights to same-gender couples and their families, but stressed that they would not be equivalent to marriage. The Labor government of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd strongly supports legislation passed in 2004 under the former Liberal government defining marriage as exclusively heterosexual. But the Same-Sex Entitlements Bill will remove discrimination against same-gender couples in some 68 Commonwealth laws involving 19 different government departments. The areas covered include Social Security, Medicare, immigration, taxation, educational assistance, veterans benefits, and elder care. A bill to remove discrimination in government pensions or superannuation was introduced earlier this year, but it's been stalled in the Senate. A report issued last year by the Federal Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission made more than 50 recommendations urging the reforms. It heard from dozens of same-gender couples during a series of hearings it held across the country, and concluded that at least 20,000 Australian lesbi-gay couples experience systematic discrimination on a daily basis. In announcing its introduction, Attorney General Robert McClellan said the legislation will not only remove discrimination against same-sex couples, it will also remove discrimination against their families, and most specifically, their children. McClellan said that the government expects the legislation to be enacted by mid-2009, but some MPs have expressed concerns that passage would undermine the unique status of heterosexual marriage in the country. LGBT advocates generally greeted the news favorably, while chiding the government for refusing to consider full marriage equality.
In the U.S., a New York judge this week rejected a challenge to Governor David Patterson's executive order requiring all state agencies to recognize same-gender marriages legally performed elsewhere. Patterson had cited New York court rulings involving same-gender couples that those marriages should be recognized under state law. In throwing out the lawsuit, filed by the right-wing Alliance Defense Fund and a handful of Republican lawmakers, Justice Lucy A. Billings of the state Supreme Court in the Bronx wrote that a same-gender couple's desire to wed represents a personal expression of emotional devotion, support and interdependence, and a public commitment. With that validity, she wrote, they expect equal treatment with other married couples. A contrary ruling, she said, would be antithetical to family stability. This was the first trial court-level decision on the issue. The plaintiffs say they'll appeal. New York's highest court has ruled that only the legislature can establish marriage equality in the state. But with nearby Massachusetts recently repealing an antiquated marriage law requiring residency, thousands of New York same-gender couples are expected to flock to the Bay State in the next few years to tie the knot.
In California, the only other U.S. state with marriage equality and no residency requirement, polls continue to report that a slim majority plan to vote against Proposition 8, a November ballot measure that would amend the state constitution and reverse the state Supreme Court-ordered right of same-gender couples to marry. Meanwhile, in a poll of likely voters taken this week in Florida, which has a constitutional same-gender marriage ban on its November ballot, 57% favor the measure, while 36% oppose it. The state constitution requires a 60% majority to amend it. Opponents warn that the proposal is so broadly written that it would also prohibit civil unions as well as domestic partner benefits currently offered in some jurisdictions. And in Arizona, the third U.S. state with a constitutional same-gender marriage ban on the ballot this November, its two Roman Catholic bishops have ordered a pastoral letter to be read in churches across the state this week supporting the measure. It says the amendment is in alignment with our deeply held moral beliefs regarding marriage. The Union for Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America also issued a statement to its Arizona congregation saying that the Torah and Jewish law affirms marriage only between a man and a woman. Evangelical churches throughout Arizona are also urging the faithful to support the amendment. According to public opinion polls, most people in the state oppose marriage equality, but they don't want to enshrine a ban in the Constitution.
In other news, 300 gay and lesbian police officers and staffers marched in the LGBT Pride Parade in Manchester, England on August 23rd. They came from 16 police forces around the United Kingdom. Sergeant Julie Barnes-Frank, coordinator of the Greater Manchester Police's Lesbian and Gay Staff Affiliation, told the Press Association that it was a record number and that there's never been anything like it in the world. England's most southwesterly county, Cornwall, saw its first pride parade on the same day in the city of Truro. Some 600 people marched, and the Gay Police Association flag flew from the Truro police station. And in Canada, about 1,200 marchers and 34,000 spectators turned out for the 19th pride parade in Ottawa, Ontario, the following day. The march made stops at the Parliament buildings and the Federal Supreme Court, both of which played a role in Canada's legalization of same-gender marriage. Capital Pride spokesman Julian Lavoie told the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation that it's important for us to keep celebrating those victories, but noted that some inequalities remain.
A late August article on the website of U.S.-based Newsweek magazine called Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Do Kill described the many obstacles its reporters encountered in trying to prepare a story about gay people in Iraq. After weeks of inquiries, the magazine set up a meeting with Nadir, who helps run one of the safe houses for Iraqi gays that are funded by foreign activists. But the night before their meeting, Nadir was visited by the Mahdi militia, the armed wing of the organization led by Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, and he called it off. The article noted that Iraqi authorities scoffed at the subject when not scolding a reporter for even asking about it. No government official would agree to be interviewed, and the report said the United Nations Human Rights Office, which has a big presence in Iraq, dodged the subject like a minefield. Gay Men, the magazine, did manage to interview, told of being thrown out of their homes and savagely attacked by religious extremists. Killing gays has become honorable in Iraq, the article said, and raping them is okay because it isn't considered a homosexual act. Only being penetrated or providing oral sex is. Nobody wants to talk about gays in Iraq, much less who is killing them, the report concluded. Changing Iraq's attitudes toward its gay minority may prove even harder than ending the war.
Back in the U.S., the Republican Party capped its four-day convention in St. Paul, Minnesota this week by officially nominating Senator John McCain of Arizona as its presidential candidate. That move was hardly a surprise, but McCain did jolt the pundits by picking little-known Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate. Her selection virtually overshadowed other media coverage of the convention. Palin has been Alaska's governor for less than 2 years and previously served as the mayor of Wasilla, a small town of about 5,000 to 7,000 people. Republican commentators have said, with straight faces, that she has experience in international affairs because Alaska's most northwesterly border is close to Russia. Christian conservatives celebrated her selection. While it's the first time the GOP has put a woman on the ticket, feminists were not exactly applauding. Palin opposes abortion, even when a birth would be the result of rape. She also supported the teaching of creationism, opposes gun control and endangered species protections, and has pushed for oil drilling in environmentally sensitive areas. She's also embroiled in a state abuse of power scandal.
Not surprisingly, Palin has a poor record on LGBT issues. She opposes hate crimes legislation and supported the 1998 state constitutional amendment defining marriage as exclusively between one man and one woman. An insert in the bulletin of the Wasilla Bible Church, where Palin has reportedly prayed since she was a child, advertised a mid-September conference in nearby Anchorage, sponsored by the notoriously anti-queer group Focus on the Family, which claims to help homosexuals go straight. Early in her administration, Governor Palin vetoed legislation to overturn a 2005 state Supreme Court ruling that ordered domestic partner benefits for gay and lesbian state workers, not because she supported those benefits, but because her legal advisors told her it would be unconstitutional to deny them. She reiterated her opposition to the benefits in her reluctant veto message. The Republican Party platform was also not exactly queer-friendly. It calls for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to define marriage as heterosexual only and opposes gays and lesbians in the armed forces, claiming the incompatibility of homosexuality with military service. The platform also opposes what it calls activist judges, right-wing code for an independent judiciary that may sometimes issue relatively progressive rulings. While his running mate strongly supports it, McCain has opposed a so-called federal marriage amendment, but he's on record in support of state constitutional amendments to ban same-gender marriage. Citing McCain's opposition to the federal amendment, however, the National Lesbi-Gay Log Cabin Republicans has endorsed his candidacy. More about that in a moment.
And finally, according to broadcast reports, the Virginia delegation to the Republican convention didn't have traditional guidebooks to help them navigate the host city this week. A campaign official from the state lieutenant governor's office canceled an order for 150 of them because they included 6 to 8 pages highlighting the city's gay and lesbian night spots. An official wrote to Rake Publishing, which distributed the guide, saying that having a section dedicated solely to GLBT will be a big problem for many of our folks. We simply can't hand them out. Some Republicans, however, apparently use their gaydar to find those night spots without the guidebooks. Queer club owners in the St. Paul area reported better than usual business during the convention.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 6, 2008. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Donna Ann Ward.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, to keep on the same subject, we have with us tonight Sue Lovell, who is at-large city council person in her second term, halfway through your second term.
I am. It's gone by so fast.
Yes. I know you've been keeping real busy. But besides that, you've been part of the Democratic Party for a long time, and in fact, on the Democratic, what is the proper term?
Democratic National Committee.
Committee. You took Billy Carr's position.
I did.
How long have you been on that?
I'm starting my third term, so 8 years.
Wow, wow.
I know. Then
congratulations
again.
On that.
So, effect, that is sort of the operations of the Democratic Party nationally.
Right, we're the board, like the national board, like you have it on any organization.
So you really knew a lot of behind the scenes. Well, of course, I know you know a lot of behind the scenes, but behind the scenes of the convention and how it was put on and how everything ran.
Did. In fact, I want to really congratulate everybody that worked on the convention. It was very well run. You know, really good time. I mean, I thought our stage and presentation was actually so much better than the Republicans, which I watched on TV. So it's a lot of work and a lot of effort. It took a couple of years to do, but I want to say thank you to everybody that worked so hard on it.
And that stadium must have been just so powerful the night of the acceptance speech.
It was very powerful. In fact, I ended up not going. My chief of staff, William Paul Thomas, I thought that he should be there really better, you know, more so than myself. Mm-hmm. And so I stayed back at the hotel with some labor union people and staff from the party and watched it on TV.
Just like the rest of us.
Yes, exactly. And but we weren't too far away, so you could see the fireworks. But everybody that came out of there said it was incredibly powerful.
Now, I saw that 6% of the convention delegates were GLBT people.
They were, that we knew of. I mean, I'm sure there were more.
Right.
And the numbers sort of, at the caucus meetings, they would announce somebody, you know, a couple of new people we had discovered or had come out during the convention. But, you know, I will say again, I think a lot of credit goes to Stonewall Democrats. I think they have been just an incredible asset to the Democratic Party, but for our community, they have really gone in there and fought for us to have really have our place. And this was the first time at a convention that actually there was a percentage of delegates that had to be GLBT, you know, to fit in. So that's why we were 6%. And I'm proud to say that Texas was in the top four states of GLBT delegates. So I was very proud of that.
Although I heard Texas was in the nosebleed section.
Well, we're always because we're so large. But actually, it's much better. You know, you're up. You know, you're sitting up, but if you're on the floor at the convention, you never get to sit down because everybody's walking through there, and you just really can't see. So our seats are really much better. You can see big screens. You know, you don't have to walk the full floor to go use the facilities or go buy food or beverages. And actually, right above us was the guest box. So the night that Ted Kennedy came and spoke, which was so emotional,
absolutely, yes,
all the Kennedy family was right above us. So we were there watching Ted Kennedy or watching the family watching Ted Kennedy. So they were great seats, actually.
Were there a lot of young people there, too?
It was, yeah. Well, I don't know if we're all just getting older and everybody looks a lot younger.
That could be.
But there were. It was great to see within the Democratic Party, you know, not just in our community, but, you know, all across the party from all states, these young people that are really energizing, enthusiastic, but really well-informed, really do care about what's happening with their government.
The platform itself, was there specific mention about GLBT issues?
There was. In fact, it's a lot stronger than it was. You know, every year it gets stronger and stronger. And, mm-hmm. and again, I really do want to credit Stonewall Democrats nationally for being there, being a presence. And also on the Democratic National Committee, you know, we have a committee there also. And we were very vocal about how we wanted to continue to strengthen, you know, the wording in the platform. So it was very good. Far better than the Republicans, I'll say that.
Well, that would be too easy to do, considering some of the stuff they say. What are some of the things they strengthened this time?
Oh, they strengthened the language on, in fact, on transgender issues. Mm-hmm. They strengthened that. They strengthened their stance on the marriage issue. I forget. So there was quite a few in there that I forget what all was on there, but everybody, my good friend Roberta Achtenberg from San Francisco was a part of that. And so when Bertie's pleased, I'm pleased. And she was very pleased with what had happened.
Good.
Yes.
So just a massive, incredible organization to see how well it, you know, it was always said the Democrats were never on time, but it looked like the convention ran pretty much on schedule. Of course, they have to hit those hours for network programming. And speeches seemed pretty good.
Speeches were great. It was well run. I will say probably, I mean, there was a lot of things to be there at the convention, but for me, really on Monday night when Ted Kennedy came out And, you know, at 58 years old, I can look back and remember when his brother was elected,
mm-hmm.
And when his brothers were assassinated, and then you know, just what a powerful senator he's become and how much he's done, and to see him, I mean, every ounce of strength to be there. He'd been in the hospital, actually. His family did not want him to come. He insisted that he would be there and would not miss it, and they brought him in a golf cart, and they put a stool up at the podium. And he walked up there and pushed that stool aside and grabbed a hold of that podium and gave one of those good, rip-roaring mm-hmm. Teddy Kennedy speeches. And then, you know, walked around the stage, and the family kept trying to get him off and and hold on to him. And he was not going to leave until he was ready to leave. But we all knew it was probably the last time we would ever hear him speak.
Do you feel that the party did unite?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And you know, I know this. We talk so much about the presidential race, but so much of governing is more than just the presidential race. I mean, there's so many other races, congressional races and Senate races, and, of course, we got our local races. But was there talk about that? And since you work behind the scenes a lot more, I mean, you just mostly see when you're watching the convention, it's all about the presidential race.
Well, you know, in every state, you know, you want to bump up the vote so that you can take back. There was, you know, particularly people were asking about Texas, what was going to happen. You know, would be able to do what Dallas had done. Would, you know, would Harris County be able to? And I think there's that it's very possible too. We're going to have to bump the vote up by 4 or 5%, but I think that's a very doable thing. I do. I think there's great excitement about this race. And you know, I mean, it's historical. Being at that convention was, you know, you were a part of a very historical moment in our history. And and especially in the Democratic Party, but for the United States of America. And so it was really a privilege to be there and be a part of it and finally see that, you know, we have the first African American nominee.
And I never heard my hometown mentioned as much as it has been in the past couple
yes.
of weeks, Scranton, Pennsylvania,
yeah.
which is really bizarre. But, you know, now that you've been in office for 3 years, and now you're really part of you know, being an elected official and stuff, and how has governing, you know, as you work so hard behind the scenes to get people elected, now you're actually in office, how does that feel?
Well, every day I walk to work, it's a privilege to walk into City Hall and serve the people of the city, and I'm truly excited about it every day. On the other side, we have term limits, so there's a part of you that know that you are one day closer to being out of office, and you know, and there's a little sadness about that. But then the feeling of, boy, I need to hurry up and get done what I need to get done. You know, I think anybody that is a good public servant, you know, considers it a privilege to be there and serve, and really wants to deliver on what they campaigned on. They want to leave some sort of mark
mm-hmm.
that they were there and that they were a good public mm-hmm. servant, you know, and changed something, their city, their town, their county, or the United States in some way. So for that, Barack Obama, you know, I mean, has certainly changed now politics by, you know, being the first African-American nominee of the Democratic Party. And we as Democrats have to be incredibly proud. When you look at the field that ran in the primaries.
And it was a very good field.
It was an incredible field. Any one of them could have been made an excellent nominee. So, you know, it's great being a part of history.
But isn't, I mean, going back to city council, but 6 years just doesn't seem like enough time to really do some things, because there's a learning curve for anyone elected newly to the workings, and then it's time to run for office again.
Some people come in and they really don't know, and there's a learning curve. I was very lucky to have been involved around City Hall and sort of know.
Oh,
here's
yeah.
where we're at a disadvantage. First of all, just at City Hall itself, when you have new elected officials or a new mayor, a new administration, department heads usually change.
Mm-hmm.
But the middle management people, they stay. And there have been people that have been there for a long time. I serve on the Houston-Galveston Area Council Transportation Policy Committee.
Mm-hmm.
We set all the transportation goals and needs 35 years out. If I'm only going to be there 6 years, Houston is the largest user of, you know, transportation.
Mm-hmm.
We're the largest customer, but our people that represent are only there 6 years. I can assure you the other 13 counties, they just wait us out. Because they know that we're going to be gone and a new set of, you know, of goals and needs will be there. And we're at a real disadvantage when it comes to regional planning. The county, Harris County and the other counties around us, which we now have to think of ourselves a regional, not just Harris County. We're all so connected. You know, what happens in Fort Bend affects us. What happens in Chambers affects us. But we're at a total disadvantage for the city to have representatives. The largest city in the region, and they can only serve 6 years.
And you're also working with a mayor who's very proactive.
I am. In fact, I'm very proud. I was elected unanimously by my colleagues as the vice mayor pro tem of the city. So
congratulations.
Thank you. It's
an
honor.
You deserve
that. Thank you. So I do work. I've known Mayor White for a long time. We have a very good relationship, and I'm very happy to be working closely with him.
So it definitely has been keeping you busy. I know you worked a lot on the graffiti ordinance, and that's a tough thing to do.
It is. It's, you know, I don't know that we'll ever get rid of it, but I think we've made an impact and raised awareness on it. In fact, this week on the agenda, we're going to do something that is going to make some people happy and some people not so happy, but it relates to our parking lots downtown. First, we're going to raise the standard. But number two, we're going to require that when you go and park, you know, when you put that money in that little box and,
right,
you
yeah.
know, whatever, actually we're going to require that they give you a receipt.
Oh, sort of like the parking meters.
Exactly.
And those really have seemed to work out pretty well.
They have. Oh. So when you go park at a private parking lot downtown now, they're going to be required to give you a receipt. You put it on your dashboard. And that way there's no mix-up whether you paid or you put it through the wrong slot, or so you can't get towed and you can't get booted, because
right.
you'll have proof of purchase. And if you walk off with it and it's not on there, if you come back, you're going to have to pay a fee, you know, because mm-hmm. they came and you didn't leave the proof there. But now we're going to require proof of purchase, which I think is very good for the customers.
Too bad they couldn't do that in the elections.
Yeah.
When you vote.
Well, you know, you know, I think that can be done. We're going to have to get a county clerk in that decides that they want to push for that. But I think that'll happen.
Well, I want to thank you for that, because I do a lot of work downtown and I use a lot of the parking facilities. And that's always a great fear, especially at certain times. And to compliment the city on their electronic parking meters, if
right.
you will. Those are so great. You
they're
know, there's a little bit of a learning curve, even for some of us older folks. But, you know, once I got it, I love it more than anything. Always have the receipt, always.
Right.
And if I have to use a credit card, I can.
Sure. And you can pick it up and move it from one spot to another.
Exactly. Or if you're down there most of the day, you buy an all-day right. ticket.
Pretty That's soon just... you'll be able to, if you're in a meeting and it's going to run out, you'll be able to get on your cell phone and pay into the meter, and so you don't have to get up and leave your meeting.
We're talking to Sue Lovell, who is an at-large city council person here in the city of Houston. What are some of the other issues that you've been working on, Sue?
Well, you know, I chair the Transportation, Infrastructure, and Aviation Committee, and, you know, we passed the consent agreement through for Metro, which is the agreement between the city of Houston and Metro as to, you know, when they do construction. You know, who does what when they open up the streets and when they're doing the construction. And that was a lot of work, but I was extremely proud to have brought it through our committee. Mm-hmm. And it allows us now to move forward with the building of our light rail lines, which we have started, which is incredibly exciting.
Well, there seems to be a lot of stuff going on in Houston. I mean, the new Discovery Green Park, which is a fabulous
mm-hmm.
park. The work around just the Elmer Tinsley Park towards downtown, that promenade that was built down there is really an incredible
right.
addition to the park system. Because it's always been said that Houston sort of is a little bit park poor.
Not anymore.
But the facilities start, you know, we don't have a lot of little pocket parks, but that's partly because we're so spread out. But we do have some really great facilities.
We have great parks. You know, Herman Park Memorial along the bayous, you know, up at Lake Houston. We've added a brand new park up there that's around the lake that has camping, you know.
And then there's now some new dog parks.
We have new dog parks and then new Discovery Green. We have two new high-rise buildings going in around Discovery Green. You know, the cranes are back. You know, the building cranes are back, which is always a good sign in
Absolutely.
A city. And so, you know, Houston is doing extremely well. We're moving forward now with a better recycling program, which is very good news. We've figured out that actually, you know, you can actually make money off recycling, and we're moving forward to do that. So Houston is right now is just in very good shape compared to some other parts of the country.
Well, and definitely we seem to hear all the scandals happening on the county level and nothing happening on the city level.
Right, yes, which is good news. I mean, I don't know if it's good for the county, but, you know, we'll have elections coming up, and if people want to take care of that, you know, they'll have the right to cast their vote. But no, I think the council right now is a good council. Everybody gets along. I attribute to the fact that half the council is women, and we communicate, you know, very well and get along very well. But the council is good. There's a real interest in making sure the city stays a city of opportunity and moves forward. So there's not the kind of rancor that you had in the past, or even the partisanship that you had before, and a lot of that has to do with Mayor White's leadership.
I had a question concerning that. One, there's two. There's the protection of some of our historical buildings and our historical areas, but as well as balancing that with some of our dangerous buildings that really are eyesores in the short term, but dangerous, and they can affect and, you know, kill a neighborhood, literally.
It's true. It's, you know, you're knowledgeable about that since you now serve on the Building and Standards
Commission.
Yes. And
that's why I asked the question. Because,
you know, this city is so pro-property rights. It's very, very hard, even when a piece of property is dangerous, that we want to seize it and do something with it. I think we're becoming more progressive about that and looking at it more in a public, you know, public safety standpoint.
Yeah.
But as far as our history, you know, I'm proud to be chairing Quality of Life Committee, in which the Historic Preservation Committee comes underneath there. Mayor White appointed me actually in my freshman year, mainly because nobody else really sort of wanted to take it on because they looked at it as a really volatile issue. Yeah. We've been able to sit down with neighborhoods and with developers and builders and point out to them that really it's very good for the city. You can be used as an economic development tool as part of preserving your history, which good cities do. So we've been able to move forward. We have the first protected historic district, the old 6th Ward, of which no buildings can be taken down. We've moved forward now. We've got, golly, 8 or 9 historic districts where people go and petition. We lowered it to 51% property owners. We're now moving forward in some of those historic areas to really put some building standards in to where when you build, it fits the, you know, it fits the character of the neighborhood. And when you do that, you get predictability. So you're willing to pay more for a house in a historic district because you know next to you is not going to be a 4 or 5 story, you know, townhome.
Yeah, or four of them on one lot.
Exactly. So the developers are getting that they can, there might be some restrictions to building, but they can actually get more money per square foot because there's predictability and people will pay for that.
And I know how people are about, you know, property rights and all, but some of the things I see that come through the commission, a brand new home against a, right next to a lot where there's a 2-story home that hasn't been touched in a long time, and it's leaning over the property line. A good wind would blow it down, but yet we're hamstrung to do anything about it.
I think you'll see on council there's more and more chatter. I think there's going to be more of a willingness now to take, you know, sort of respect people's property, but when you don't respect other people's property, then there's no reason why your property shouldn't be taken down. Because it also brings down the property value, of which hurts the city. When property values go down, you know, less taxes are collected, and it hurts the city. So it's really to our advantage to make sure that property values stay up.
Yeah. So when are city council meetings, and they're open to the public?
City council meetings are on Tuesday afternoons, usually start around 1:30. That's public session where anybody can come and have their say about agenda items and non-agenda items. And then on Wednesday morning around 9 o'clock, when the mayor decides to start, usually around 9, then the formal council meeting starts where we vote on on the ordinances and agenda items.
And those meetings are broadcast on Comcast Cable, Channel 17?
They are, I believe so.
16.
I think it's 16, yes.
Sue Lovell, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Sure, thank you.
And good luck next 3 years. You got an election coming up in a year.
I do. I know. It goes too fast. I do want to say to everyone, first of all, please, get involved in some way in a campaign. This election is so important, not just to the nation, but to us here in Harris County.
That's being a community organizer is not a bad word.
Being a community organizer is a great thing. It is. But this election, this presidential election, is tightening up every day. It is just extremely important to first you get registered to vote, find someone and get them registered to vote, and then make sure you get them to the polls. Pick a campaign. Go and volunteer. Democratic Party has a coordinated campaign office right across from the Breakfast Club at, was it, Alabama and Travis. Can't miss it. Has signs all
that's
over
right,
it.
Richmond.
Richmond, right.
Yes.
Please
yes.
go and volunteer.
And the
it is, it's Alabama because it's right across
from right, Alabama. Alabama. Yeah. Right. We're, right. Yes.
Richmond is a Sears. Alabama is a
right.
coordinated.
And if you want to get some more information about Sue Lovell, you can call her at 311. They'll be able to direct your call from there.
They will, or I'll give you my number. It's at the office. It's 832-393-3013.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew. And coming up in our second hour, we have Ray Hill with the Life and Times of Del Martin. And we also have more from This Way Out.
Just one glimpse of you is all I need. Knowing that you breathe the same air I breathe. But perhaps I should start with something simple. Like, what's your name? What is your history? What is your game? What is your pleasure? What is your pain? I want to know what is your name. Maybe we could go outside for once, spend some time together and we could talk. I want to know. Catch the furtive glances you throw my way. I wanna know all there is to know. I wanna know what makes your heart grow. But perhaps I should start with something simple. Like, what's your name? What is your history? What is your game? What is your pleasure? What is your pain? I want to know what is your name. Maybe we could go outside for a walk, spend some time together and we could talk. I want to know what is your name. We could do dinner and have a good time. Just relax, share a bottle of wine. And if well done, stuck out, I will make love that's divine. Oh, I could be your partner, I could be your friend, I could be your lover till the very end. But there's something I should know before we begin. What is your history? What is your game? What is your pleasure? What is your pain?
from 2006, a CD called Proof. That was Roger Kuhn and a cut called What Is Your Name? Or just, What's Your Name? This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Levinka.
And we are here in the studio with Ray Hill. Everybody knows Ray.
The Relic.
The Relic Ray. But we're here to talk about Dale Martin, who passed on August 27th of this year. And tell us something about
Dale. Well, I met
Dale
in Chicago in 1968. There was a meeting of the North American Conference of Homophile Organizations just before the Democratic National Convention in 1968. Which is a rather famous convention, actually. Mm-hmm. And Dale Martin was there. Phyllis Lyon, who was her companion, was not there. Phyllis had a conflict of schedule and couldn't make it. But Dale and I were members of 18 registered delegates.
GLBT delegates before it was GLBT?
Well, it was the North American Conference of Homophile Organizations, and you can throw homophile on your computer and your spell check will tell you there ain't no such word.
But no such word, okay.
Right. And of course, that acronym is NACHO. N-A-C-H-O.
Oh, my God.
So we called it NACO, because NACHO had not yet been invented on the menu or anything else. And trying to, of course, I give a lot of thought before I can come down here and be on your important show. And so how do you explain to people in 2008 what it was like when the entire national out leadership of the gay, lesbian, transgendered community was 20 people? There were two other people there besides the 18 registered guests. One was Troy Perry, who had just founded a church, and he thought going to a political meeting as the founder of a church might create some conflict of interest. And Harry Hay, who is the real founding father of the movement, was on his way back from Eastern Europe to bring us the news that East Germany was the first European nation that decriminalized homosexual intimacy, which is something that happened in 2003 in Texas. It had happened in 1968 in East Germany.
It just took a while to the right. word to get here. Right.
And well, the reason East Germany did is they had those monuments. And Dale was one of three women there. There were 20 folks. 18 of them registered, three women, Barbara Geddings,
uh-huh.
Dale Martin, and Rita Wanstrom, who was part of the Texas delegation. We went with some degree of gender parity to the conference. Rita took Ricky Cortez, who incidentally also died last week, but Ricky did not register as a participant, but she was there for all the meetings.
Okay.
So there were actually four women, three registered there. Of that 18 registered and three not registered, 21 people, six are alive.
Oh, and you're right. In this day, in 2008, we just don't know. It's hard to remember back 20 years.
We wouldn't have a concept. And let me tell you, I had an enormous amount of admiration for Dale Martin. Dale Martin and Phyllis Lyon together are founders of the Daughters of Bilitis, and they mispronounced it. Bilitis is what they called it, but it's a Greek pronunciation. It's daughter Bilitis. And their newspaper was the ladder. The symbolism is that the ladder would get us out of the depressed place of where we were
right.
at that time. And the men in the movement were shamelessly sexist. Shamelessly. As a matter of fact, Phyllis and Sue had gone to Phyllis and Dale had gone to other conferences, and they were just basically shut out because they were women.
Exactly.
Now, Ray, how did you find? How did people find each other back then? I mean, there was
well,
the internet. How did the gays kind of unite?
Well, we had the help of the three registered guests who were actually undercover agents for the FBI.
Oh.
There were three of the 18 registered guests were undercover agents of the FBI. And
Hoover would have been around then, so yeah. These were Hoover's boys.
Hoover's boys is literally true.
Air quotes.
Yeah, right. And they literally, one of them was in Kansas City, and he was had started a program of everybody send him their local newsletters, which would have been one for one incorporated out of Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and the Mattachine papers
yeah.
out of Washington, mm-hmm. New York, and San Francisco, and Sir Society for Individual Rights in San Francisco, but everybody was either from New York or Los Angeles, San Francisco.
The big gay.
Except country. For five of us. One of them was that undercover agent in Kansas City. three Texas delegates, who incidentally are all still alive. I saw David Patterson this weekend. It was David Patterson, myself, and Rita. And Brian Coyle came down from Minneapolis. Everybody else was East Coast and West
right.
Coast. So East Coast didn't trust West Coast. And West Coast didn't trust East Coast.
Right.
So I chaired most of the meeting because they didn't trust one another to chair. And the big issue was Frank Kameny's motion that we adopt gay is good. Mm-hmm. Not great, mind you, just good. And that was debated for 3 hours.
Wow.
And it carried by a small margin. With a bunch of abstentions.
Oh, wow.
So nobody fights like small, powerless groups. and that's what we were. But I remember Dale carried herself with such dignity because her being there was resented by the guys
gay men, yeah.
from New York. Barbara Geddings... was there, but she was just kind of one of the guys. and she blended in with Frank Kameny and Barbara Geddings and Bruce Voller from New York. And the people from San Francisco were almost openly hostile mm-hmm. to that. And then I met her again in 1977 when they did the No on Six campaign in California. She and a group of other organizers came to Texas raising money to support our side of that race, which was successful. Mm-hmm. We defeated that referendum in California. And she was here, and she was a kind of a quiet person, very, very well organized. You have to be well organized to edit and publish a newsletter. Of so as much important, you know, we don't have anything. The Journal of Homosexuality comes closest to be the heir of the latter. The latter was an academic, intellectual, spirit lifting publication that was so important to women whose identity was emerging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always been male, but I don't think I've ever been male enough. And I used to read the latter and translate that so that the same concepts and ideas would be suitable to males. And I did that basically when I was editor of TWIT. I was editor of TWIT for a while, and I used to write essays in TWIT that would actually plagiarize the concepts of latter articles and turn them into male consumption things.
But that's what happens when we're powerless, struggling to actually emerge from where we were placed during those years.
Even at that time, psychologists still classified homosexuality as a mental disorder.
Can you imagine what they still say for trans people?
We began the movement against that, and Barbara Geddings, who was very important in that movement because she went to the American Psychological Association, and that history is well recorded. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Dale and Phyllis's contributions to our history, other than the tangible copies of the latter, and I'm sure they kept all of the minutes of the Daughters of Miletus. I am certain.
Well, let's hope
so.
Yeah.
Other than those tangible things, their movement was inside. Mm-hmm. Barbara Geddings' movement to psychological pathology was contact with the outside world, mm-hmm. and we're not nearly as effective at remembering the inside stuff as we are the outside stuff. But I called and asked to come down and remember Dale because six of us out of 21. I mean, it's a dying breed, the pioneers. And, of course, Dale and Phyllis preceded me. I mean, I was a puppy in 1968.
Yes, and 40 years ago.
40 years ago, yeah. And it brings to mind that because of that pioneering work, our movement has come farther in one generation.
Absolutely.
Than any movement in history.
It's the greatest social change in humanity for social rights movement.
For a short period of time. Yeah. One generation is nothing.
Yeah, it's a blink.
To eternity.
Yeah.
There's a black civil rights movement existed outside of the public view for generations before it emerged in the earlier 60s, late 50s and earlier 60s, the women's equality movement struggled for generations before they were able to make major accomplishments. And we have gone from being criminals everywhere to being criminals nowhere in less than 40 years.
And it's actually amazing. We're on the verge of being able to marry legally. And the best thing, I think, The coolest thing is that Dale and Phyllis were able to be married.
I'm giving a speech about that.
When are you giving that speech?
It's a conference of AU, Americans United. And can I practice my lines?
Sure.
I mean, it's just a short piece.
Give us
a short piece. This guy. And when he was growing up, the most important thing in the world to him was to have a family. That was the most important thing for him, was to have a family. He dreamed of having a family. He thought his whole life was around having a family.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got when he got out of school, he got a job, and then he got another job. And he worked, labored, and he saved all of his money because you need money to buy houses and families, and kids cost money and all that. And he saved money. And then he got into, even after two jobs, he'd come home and work on his house because he got into flipping houses.
Mm.
So that's a pretty good way to accumulate money.
Yeah,
and he accumulated a whole lot of money, but in the process of working all this hard, he developed these horrible migraine headaches. I mean, his head, he went to doctors, and doctors referred him to specialists and more specialists and doctors. And finally they said, we really don't know what's causing your migraine headaches, but we have found that by removing your testicles, the headaches will go away. And he said, no, the families are too important to me. And so he kept on doing it. But the headaches got so bad, finally he yielded. And he had the operation. And he woke up and the headaches were not there. And they never came back. And so, but he had all this money that he'd been saving for this family that he dreamed of. So he went to the best clothing store in town and said, I want a new wardrobe. I want suits and
coats and ties and slacks and socks and shoes and ties. And, oh, by the way, I need underwear. And the guy said, what size underwear? He said, 32 boxers, 32 briefs. And he said, no. I measured you for your suit. You need something larger than 32 briefs. And he said, what do you mean? I've worn 32 briefs since I did. He said, didn't you know that wearing your briefs too tight will cause headaches?
But
the clerk was attractive. So they went to San Francisco, got married, and adopted a couple of children from Central America and lived happily ever after.
Oh, that's a great story. that's...
I love this radio station. I love this radio show. My name is Ray Hill. If you're bored to death Friday, listen to The Prison Show.
Friday nights?
Friday nights at 9 o'clock.
Absolutely. That's great. Well, tell us more about Dell. See, is there anything we've
missed? Well, that's the kind of gal Dell was. She was a drinker, and I wasn't. But her jokes didn't deteriorate as she drank more. And
probably
so,
got better, huh?
Yeah, well, she thought they did.
Yeah, of course.
And they stayed about the same to the rest of us. And we would sit around and drink. And they were poker players.
Oh.
Shame on you. I mean, go to a meeting with Phyllis and Dale, and that's fine. But don't play poker with them. I mean, they're poker faces.
They play under the table.
And at one point, they drove an RV. And the male organizations had a rule that you couldn't call the meeting to order if the RV was parked outside because they used it as a caucus space for the women. You know, we didn't have much of that in Houston. We didn't have that polarity between men and women. We didn't have that polarity here between transgendered people and gay and lesbian people. We were always kind of inclusive in our attitude toward those.
What do you think that is, Ray?
Well, I think we're out of the mainstream. You know, whenever Ed Barnes moved down here from San Francisco and came to the caucus and told us what a wonderful organizer he was in San Francisco and proceeded to tell us how San Francisco did it, we said, we don't give a damn how San Francisco did it. We ain't going to do it that way.
The South, yeah.
we were out of the mainstream. Everybody in the rest of the country thought that this was a rough territory.
Yeah.
But really, it wasn't. I went to my 50th anniversary of my high school graduation last Saturday.
Congratulations. That's remarkable.
And I am so glad that I'm not as old as those people.
Did you go to high school, a bunch of old people?
Galena Park High School.
Galena
Park High School. But I went with the last girlfriend that I had in junior high school.
Oh, my gosh.
Sue Beth Ware, now Sue Beth Fry, and I went as a date to our high school graduation
Scandal.
Anniversary. And, no, Sue Beth, we were actors, and we were in all the plays. And,
okay.
And I played the male lead, and she played the female lead. And then she said last night, she said, well, whenever I got to the senior play, I wasn't active in Galena Park High School. I'd been active in drama in junior high school. And I got a bit part in the senior play. And I didn't get to be your leading lady. And I resented. I said, Sue, resented? It's been 50 years.
50 years.
And she said, it's been 49. And I said, oh, okay. And you're going to get over this in a year. But the reason when I talk about Dale, I go back to my history, because Dale is an important part of my history. It's an important part of all of our history. And I want to tell the listeners in the minute that I have remaining, think back where you were in junior high school and in high school. Now, some of you I know are in junior high school and high school, but obviously the rest of you are not in high school. Think back how far you have come. That has been a truly remarkable journey.
It certainly has.
And it would not have been possible if it had not been for a quiet, loving woman and her companion, Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, actually, even for the men, for all of us, set the pace of two people loving one another. And, of course, one of the last things that happened in her life is they were legally married at San Francisco. They were the first Californians to legally marry after all of the wrangling over what the law says and when it went in force. And that is the one grace. But go to your Google, look up Daughters of Bilitis, and it's B-L-I-T-I-S, and look up the latter, and look up Dale Martin and Phyllis Lyon, and get a grip on that history. It's important to your life.
Thank you. We've been talking with Ray Hill as a tribute to Dale Martin.
D-E-L Martin.
Yeah, this is Jennifer Renee, and this is Queer Voices.
Called Ex-Boyfriends, the track Situation from their 2007 CD In With. This is Queer Voices.
We believe in a strong defense, work, faith, service, a culture of life. personal responsibility, the rule of law, and judges who dispense justice impartially and don't legislate from the bench.
Republican presidential nominee Senator John McCain came no closer than that to addressing LGBT issues in his September 4th acceptance speech at the GOP's National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota. Backed by the largest lesbi-gay contingent ever and the first to be officially credentialed at the convention, the board of the Log Cabin Republicans voted 12-2 to endorse McCain. Their president, Patrick Salmon, explained to CNN anchor Soledad O'Brien why the organization could look past the Republican platform's call for a federal amendment banning same-gender marriage.
Well, I think Senator McCain is an inclusive leader who can return the party to unifying core principles. In recent years, the party got off track by focusing on divisive social issues. 4 years ago, President Bush ran for re-election trying to use gay and lesbian people as a wedge issue by supporting the federal marriage amendment. Senator McCain is a much different kind of candidate. He's bringing the party together. He's someone who courageously voted against the federal marriage amendment and paid a price for it among social conservatives. So I'm optimistic, and Log Cabin is certainly proud to endorse Senator McCain. We're not going to agree on every issue, but at the same time, he's someone who can bring the party together and I think move it in a direction that's more inclusive.
You mentioned the wedge issue, and I guess I would say, well, you talk about Senator McCain. On the other hand of that is what is clearly and explicitly called for in the platform for the Republican Party is a constitutional amendment that would define marriage as a union between a man and a woman, a constitutional amendment. Obviously, Senator sure. John McCain, as the nominee, official leader, of course, has signed off on that platform and is in agreement with that platform. That doesn't give you pause?
Oh, no. I mean, certainly I disagree with a lot of what's in the platform, certainly what's in there related to gay rights, but I think the platform is largely symbolic. The day after it's passed, people don't pay attention to it. The important thing is that Senator McCain opposes the federal marriage amendment, opposed that constitutional amendment. I'd rather have a candidate that agrees with me than a platform that agrees with me. It's also important to point out that among rank-and-file Republicans, there's much stronger support for gay rights, even among convention delegates. The CBS News poll showed that 49% of the GOP delegates favor civil unions or marriage equality for gay and lesbian people. 77% of Republicans don't think that a business should have the right to fire someone because of their sexual orientation. 64% of Republicans think that gays and lesbians should be allowed to serve in the military. Certainly there's a loud and vocal segment of our party among social conservatives who are hostile to gay rights, but among rank-and-file Republicans, I think there's much broader support for gay rights than people think.
But for all those statistics that you just cited for me, if you were to go look on the Democratic side, we'd probably see those numbers significantly higher. So it seems to some degree that Democrats would have more in common with your core issues and your core values than the Republicans. So why not support Democrats?
Well, I agree with 90% of what the Republican Party supports. I don't think government is the solution to every problem. I think we need an aggressive foreign policy that takes on the terrorists. I think we need fiscal responsibility. I don't think we need government intruding too deeply in health care. I think we need a market-based approach to health care reform. I think that the economy, we need limited government. We need businesses to have the ability to not have interference from government. So across the board, I'm supportive of Republican issues. At the same time, the Republican Party isn't where it needs to be on gay and lesbian issues. I'm the first to admit that, but I think it's important to work from inside the party to make it better, because ultimately gay rights will be impossible to achieve unless there's support from both Republicans and Democrats.
That was Log Cabin Republicans President Patrick Salmon at the Republican National Convention with CNN's Soledad O'Brien.
Hello, this is Judge David Young. You are listening to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
Not many outsiders got an inside view of the once-a-decade Lambeth Conference of Anglican Bishops in mid-August. Ex-gay activist and performance artist Peterson Toscano brought his unique perspective to the event and shared his observations with This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching.
You just spent the last couple of weeks hanging out in England, observing activities around the Lambeth Conference.
It was kind of a whirlwind tour. I actually was in Malta before then with a group of LGBT Catholic folks.
Wow.
Who are very courageous. They started a group there in a very Catholic, anti-gay, heterosexist world, and they're doing amazing work. Then I was on the island of Guernsey, one of the Channel Islands, and got to talk with a lot of evangelical leaders about LGBT concerns. And then I went to the Lambeth Conference, where I got to see a lot of bishops wearing very colorful frocks, telling gays they should not be ordained. Although it was awfully tempting after seeing them in their frocks. I wanted to be ordained, and I'm a Quaker.
So did you actually get to watch the Lambeth Conference? This is something that you can actually, as a member of the public, go and see? Or did you get some kind of special dispensation?
Well, you only could get in the inner sanctum if you are a bishop. And then there are some events that are for bishops and bishops' spouses. But for the rest of the public, you really don't get in. But one thing that was very interesting, I was on the official fringe program on campus there. So they had the main events, then they had official fringe events. And then, of course, there were some unofficial fringe events going on as well.
Okay,
so I was there on campus, living in the dorms right by next to bishops and seeing them in the lobbies and connecting with them. But I couldn't go into any of the main bishop sort of talks. That was just for bishops.
So the fringe events were sort of extracurricular Lambeth Conference activities?
Exactly. Okay. They were part of the official program that were well advertised and right there on campus. So it just fringe was that it was just not the main tent events that were going on.
Okay.
I think I was the only kind of theatery sort of person there. Most of the people were speakers that were there, and then I was the oddball performer and Quaker.
So you got to perform your... Did you do the ex-gay, you know, doing time in the homo, nomo... I can't remember how it is.
Homo, nomo, halfway house.
Halfway house, that's it.
I didn't do the whole play. I did excerpts from it because I knew I'd have a mixed crowd, and I felt that they needed to hear a little bit about my personal story, about why I spent 17 years and over $30,000 on three continents attempting to de-gay myself. And so my hope was to let them see that I was very sincere in my desire to change, but I was under false pretenses often because I didn't have enough information and I had some of the wrong information. Mm-hmm. So I did a little talk, I did some performance, and I read some poems as well, and then took a lot of questions from people.
So you were doing this then primarily for bishops?
There were several bishops that came to both times, from what I can tell, from what people told me of who was in the audience. It was always hard to tell who was and who was not a bishop. Some of them didn't look very bishop-y at all. I was like, that's a bishop? It looks like a hippie, if you ask me.
What does a bishop look like, Peterson?
Exactly. I don't know. But, sometimes they had this, like, colorful sort of fuchsia shirt that kind of signified they were a bishop. And their lanyards on their around their necks would indicate that they were bishops. The Archbishop of Wales, after he saw my presentation, wanted to give me his lanyard so that I can go into the bishop's sessions because he said, we need you in there and not me. But I don't think I could have passed as the Archbishop of Wales.
Do they all know each other? Like, you know, if you had attempted to walk into the bishop's inner sanctum, would they have immediately picked you out? Do you think? Like, you can't tell what a bishop looks like, but do you think they could look at you and go, that's not a bishop?
I wonder if they have, like, bishop dar, kind of like gaydar, and they're like, that smells like a bishop. I have a feeling they kind of know each other fairly well, although there's a lot of them. I mean, there are like 880 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible number like that.
Mm-hmm. So what were you able to observe? Like, what did you see?
Well, I was there on campus, so there were, you know, a lot of downtime, you know, people walking from one thing to another, sitting, having coffee, conversations. They had these little discussion groups that would take place first thing in the morning where they talked a lot about sexuality, and there were a few of them that were outdoors. It was beautiful weather, so people were able to sit in groups outdoors, and I got to see a lot of people sitting and listening and talking, which I think really pissed off the media. Because they wanted to have, you know, a blood fest and cat fights and all of that. And it was really a lot of cordial sitting and listening. And I think it was because some of the most intense people chose not to come. And so the people who were really interested in some dialogue were there. I also got to be in the marketplace where the bishops often walk through, and this is where they sold those fabulously gorgeous-looking frocks that tempted me so. And there were a lot of stalls set up for different people, and I was surprised there were at least four different LGBT-affirming groups that were set up there engaging in conversations with people as they walked by, and there was a lot of that happening.
So did you yourself, like, sit down and have conversations with bishops about this stuff?
I didn't talk to many bishops, no, because they were kind of segregated in a lot of ways. There were a lot of other peripheral people and priests and other clergy that were there that I got to have conversations with, and conversations with other LGBT people about some of these issues. It was interesting because it gave people a chance to strategize. I also was really, really fortunate to meet some LGBT people from parts of Africa, from Nigeria and Uganda, who came courageously to come to tell their stories, which is just so critical that, you know, stories from all parts of the world come out. And so that was really, really helpful for me to hear their stories.
Wow. Like, holy smokes. Are there actual gay groups in Nigeria and places like that?
There are definitely networks that exist. There are virtual communities online where people can't give their full names, for sure. But these are courageous folks. And there was a new film that came out that they showed an excerpt of about some of their stories. And I just sat there and my mouth just dropped open just seeing these people on film telling their stories, knowing that in some cases they were putting their lives in danger, where they could have been arrested, but it was really amazing, you know, because they felt it was far more important that they be honest about who they were. And then others who, you know, even in dangerous places, because they had so much integrity, how their community welcomed them in, because they were not ashamed of themselves, so they didn't give people permission to treat them shamefully.
Now, one of the things that went on around Lambeth was that Gene Robinson, who's the openly gay bishop of New Hampshire, who has been kind of the lightning rod for a lot of the controversy around queers in the church, he wasn't invited to Lambeth, but he went to England and did his own series of public appearances. So did you follow him around at all? Did you see any of his activities?
He was kind of unavoidable. For someone who was not invited, he was the most present person there. In fact, he actually came through the marketplace at one point. And so you couldn't miss him. And it was very interesting because there was a whole buzz about him all the time. And he was doing talks and meeting with people and that. And at one point, I almost felt that it was almost too much, that it seemed to overshadow some of the work that these other organizations, Integrity from the Canadian Episcopal Church and in the U.S. and other groups in the U.K., it seemed to overshadow their work. And I felt at times it's like, wow, I wish these folks would get a chance to speak to the press and to be more visible.
But did you personally get to talk to Gene Robinson?
I did, and it's so funny because we know all the same people. I refer to him, of course, affectionately as the gay Gene. The gay Gene in the Anglican Church. So we didn't get to connect with each other. In fact, we had competing events one night, and so we were drawing crowd off of each other. But his was an invitation only, while I was open to everyone. So I think I may have had more people as a result.
Gotcha. How was the media coverage of the whole thing? Can you give
us a
picture?
Sure. I have a friend of mine who works for the BBC, and his response was, well, we went to the Bish Bash, and there was a whole lot more bishing than bashing. And they were all disappointed because they didn't get, you know, that cat fight. It's funny because you had all these people from, you know, the Times of London and all running around trying to find a story. And in the end, it was a bunch of people sitting down, talking and listening to each other, which wasn't particularly sexy.
But what about Gene Robinson's events? Did they get covered?
Very much so. Oh, yeah. I mean, anytime the man sneezed, it got covered. I mean, and I think because they thought maybe sparks would fly there. And, you know, he definitely was a celebrity walking around there. He was like a little mini rock star, which, you know, was great. I mean, that he got that kind of attention. And he's brilliant. I mean, the man is so smart, and he ties in issues of sexism and racism so beautifully and really broadens the discussion. And if anyone hasn't read his book, I suggest you run out and get it, because it's got some great stuff in it. And so as a result, he got a good hearing. People in the UK in particular definitely got to hear what he had to say.
We'll hear more with Heather Kitching and ex-gay activist performer Peterson Toscano about his experiences at the Lambeth Conference and more next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Chris Wilson, Donna Ann Ward, Rex Watner with Bill Kelly, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is supported by charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep us on the air. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive our weekly email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KUCR Riverside, California, 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, WEOS Geneva and Ithaca, New York, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. Now, last week, because we were preempted by the political convention, we missed playing This Way Out audio file that J.D. does every month. J.D. Doyle, he does that every month for This Way Out. And so we have it here, and so we're going to play it now.
The sixth album by Ellis is called Break the Spell. Hi, I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Audiophile. The album is personal, intimate, and hopeful. She'll draw you in.
Well, first of all, this is my favorite record I've ever made, and the comments I keep getting about it haven't been about the production or the arrangements. You know, folks just keep telling me that it's very, very real, and I can't think of a better compliment than that. What I really want to do is touch people and open their hearts, and I think this record does that.
You and me alive, shot the king. There's so much sweet that I can hardly wait. There's an underbelly, there is a stomach ache, but I can't help myself. I want you anyway.
Find out more about the album Break the Spell by Ellis at www.ellis-music.com.
Come in, sit down, take a load off your feet. Enjoy the atmosphere, the sound of the beat of your heart, joining in to the rhythm of the room. Breathe it in, shake it off, let go of the gloom. Feel free to stir things round or finally be still. step on up and believe what you will.
Truth Stained Lies is the second full-length album by Ron Morris, and it's an invitation to explore your own truths.
The new album is a collection of stories that I tell myself and other people tell me about who I am, what I'm scared of, what should happen, what did happen, why it happened, on and on and on. And I feel like we all face those questions about identity and perspective. What part of it is fact? What is fiction? And I've discovered there's a little bit of truth in all of it and a fair share of lies.
Why bother? The world's so big anyway. All these critics in my head keep talking and talking and talking, pushing me back into bed. I'm tossing and turning, but baby, I'm learning. I am ready to rise.
You can learn more about Ron Morris's album, Truth Stained Lies, at www.ronmorrismusic.com.
Canadian artist James Collins is not only an actor on the stage, film, and TV, but now has released his debut album called The Messenger.
Oh my God, you look like hell. But you say you feel so good. You don't worry about yourself. But if I were you, I think I would. Used to be Mr. Together. Now that guy's nowhere in sight. Can't believe that you can see it. But since she crept into your life.
Collins has had a number of successes over the years as a songwriter, putting other people on the charts. But now, he's decided to sing his own songs.
My album is called The Messenger, which is a mixture of pop songs covering lots of different subject matters. Actually, I did get the title from a clairvoyant one day that said, "You're a messenger in this world," without knowing I was a songwriter.
I said you're too much in a hurry to get nowhere. Take a deep breath.
Find out more about the CD The Messenger by James Collins at www.jamesl.collins.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at our new address, 594 Sawdust Road, number 273, Spring, Texas, 77380, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiophile.org.
Audiophile is produced by J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Keep listening.
So kind of a bonus segment there from This Way Out. Last week's audio file from J.D. Doyle.
Yes, J.D. Doyle of Queer Music Heritage.
Did you switch to another mic? No, you're just not close to it. That's it.
Here I am. How's that?
Okay. Sometimes, you know, these guys, they just switch mics on me, and I'm just like, wow, wow, wow. But, okay.
It's to keep you awake.
Yes.
I know it. This late at night, you're trying to keep me awake?
We're so late in the evening, see? That's just it. We're up. You should be up and listening.
What you got?
Well, I wanted to thank the people that were here tonight. Yeah,
yeah, but you're not going to do that yet, though.
I know that. But
before we do that, I want to make one quick announcement. This Saturday is a volunteer orientation. If you're interested in getting into politics or getting involved with the GLBT Political Caucus, it will be at 11 a.m. at the office, which is at 1915 Commonwealth at Welsh. If you'd like more information, you can go to thecaucus.org or call us up at 713-521-1000.
Yeah. And should we have a hurricane visitor, be sure to call the caucus and see, make sure everything is okay. Hopefully it won't hit us, but one never knows the way these hurricanes are this season.
We would like to thank our guest tonight, David Elliott, who calls us in usually on the first Monday of every month from Washington to give us a sort of a roundup of politics.
And thanks Sue Lovell, a city council member at large, for coming and talking to us about the Democratic convention where she was a participant.
And also Ray Hill, who was our resident historian and also our Supreme Court reporter.
Yes, and pundit, seems like, most of the time. Also, we want to thank This Way Out and for the news program, and of course J.D. Doyle for Queer Music Heritage and his bit of segment that we had a little while ago from This Way Out.
And we'll see you next week.
Good night.
You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Second Annual Family Fun Run and Bike Ride 2008, presented by the Council for Family Health Education and sponsored by Tour de Hood, will be held on Saturday, September 27th at Texas Southern University, starting at 7:30 a.m. Last year, over 100 fathers, mothers, grandparents, and children shared a morning together walking, biking, talking, and enjoying each other's company. Year 2 promises to be bigger and better. KPFT is organizing fun run and bike ride teams with your favorite programmers, so keep listening for more KPFT team information in the near future. Registration is underway online. Booth and sponsorship information is also online. Visit kpft.org for details or email info@familyhealthed.org. Bring your family out for a fun day of walking, biking, and running with Tour de Hood, Council for Family Education, KPFT, Houston, and a host of other family-oriented organizations on Saturday, September 27th at Texas Southern University.
Artist Rescue Mission invites you to attend the premiere of In Between at the Rice Media Center on Wednesday, September 10th at 7:30 p.m. A film by local artist Tish Stringer, In Between chronicles the culture and crisis of exiled Iraqi artists as a prelude to an international Iraqi art show at the Station Museum this fall. The director and two of the exiled Iraqi artists from the film will speak live in person. That's the premiere of the film In Between and a discussion of Iraqi art in crisis on Wednesday, September 10th at 7:30 p.m. 7:30 p.m., Rice Media Center. For more information, call 713-444-2477 or artistrescuemission.org.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.